KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forums next hour, how should we determine what is or isn't worth preserving as a landmark? In yesterday's San Francisco Chronicle, John King writes about the attempts to designate the faux Polynesian kitsch tonga room at San Francisco's Fairmont Hotel on the top of Nob Hill as a landmark. There are 260 official landmarks in San Francisco, including City Lights Bookstore in North Beach and the Redstone Building in the Mission, which has served as the home to labor organizations and social activists. Should a tiki bar join the ranks? All about landmarks in the hour ahead, with your calls and emails included after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. And what you're hearing there are the sounds of the thunder, lightning, and rain that falls every 20 minutes in the Tonga Room. The Tonga Room, how do you go from Afghanistan to the Tonga Room? Well, on Forum, you do. It was born in 1945 when the hotel converted its indoor swimming pool into a bar at the Fairmont Hotel, but it wasn't until 67 that the Tonga Room got its full Polynesian look, and many of you, of course, know the Tonga Room, whether you're tourists listening to us outside of San Francisco and particularly people here in San Francisco. It's at the bottom of San Francisco's Fairmont Hotel and known to many across the country, built, as I said, in 1945 and coming under threats of extinction with the possibility of condominium conversion. With its pop faux Polynesian motifs, which include a pool-time lagoon, thatch walls, island huts, and indoor monsoons to go with the Mai Tais, the Tonga Room may be the best-preserved tiki bar in California. And you may ask, what is a tiki bar? It's an exotic-themed drinking establishment that serves fancy cocktails. Should this be a landmark? Well, John King, in yesterday's Chronicle, wrote about the San Francisco Chronicle, wrote about this because there are those who feel that, yes, it should be given landmark status. And in fact, we thought it would be fascinating to just talk about what should and shouldn't be in the realm of landmark status. Here in San Francisco, there are about 260 official landmarks, including, as John King points out in his article, City Lights Bookstore in North Beach and the Redstone Building in the Mission, which has served as a home to a number of labor organizations as well as social activists. But how do you determine what ought to be a landmark? And we've got sort of different generations here in studio with us. John King is urban design writer and journalist with the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome, John. Good morning.
Thanks very much.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Chris Verplank, who's an architectural historian with Kelly, and Verplank Historical Resources Consulting. And welcome to you.
Thank you.
And you're kind of on two different sides of this, I think, which may represent the generational sides, because as you sort of intimated in your article, John, what needs preservation may have to do with how well preserved the person is in terms of cultural history.
Yeah, I mean, we're not that far apart in age. I just look old. It's the strains of the journalism business. But I think right now preservation is really the most interesting. It's one of the most interesting strands of urbanity there is in terms of how do you define the landscape around you. And you look at a city like San Francisco. In San Francisco, as well as other cities, the preservation movement really got its start in the 60s. You know, that's kind of the landmarks. The first one was in 1968 and things. Back then, there was kind of an assumed past. Everyone could agree on this is what San Francisco is. This is why we all love it. This is what's under threat. You know, you fast forward into 2009, there's so many different cultures. There are so many different strands of measuring. And the buildings that were kind of the new threat in the 60s are now old enough to become registered landmarks. So you get this, you know.
Including the best tiki bar in California.
Yeah, it's far and away the best tiki bar in California. You know, it's fascinating.
But so is the whole question about, like you said, what should and shouldn't be reserved. There's a sense of tiki bars, though, that many people find extraordinarily nostalgic. I mean, you touch on this in your article. Here in San Francisco, you just think about Trader Vic's, for example, which is now Le Colonial. But South Pacific has come back from Broadway, and you've got all these motifs that make us associate with all the redolent. I think you mentioned Bing Crosby's Waikiki.
Waikiki,
yeah, in your column. So all of this is memorable to people, but it's the architecture that we're talking about here, this high-style architecture.
Right. Well, the case that Chris makes, and I'll let him go into more detail, yeah. but it's a very solid case, is this isn't just bring in a few potted palms and put a figurine or two up in the corner. You know, the room is very much an overall creation with the lava walls, the thatch roof, so on and so forth. And where, again, where kind of I think a lot of the balancing act comes in becomes, is there some sort of objective hurdle where we can say, yes, we have an affection for this. Yes, this is an idiosyncrasy in an increasingly homogenized society, but that is a cultural shift more than an architectural thing to be saved. But, you know, it's an argument that's being redefined every day in cities like San Francisco.
Yeah, we wanted to get some of the people who make these decisions on. We invited them, but, I mean, to me, it's a little bit mysterious, maybe Byzantine, the way they make these decisions. I'd like to know more about them. But, Chris, what gives you the decision that this is important to preserve? I think John said in his article, maybe getting the Tonga Room as a landmark is a little bit like saying we ought to preserve a Hawaiian shirt.
A good Hawaiian shirt.
A good Hawaiian shirt.
And I have some of those. No, my main sense about Polynesian pop is it's more than just preserving tiki bars. This was an entire cultural movement that was widespread in California during the 1950s and indeed the rest of the United States. You know, at its apex in the early 60s, you had bowling alleys. You had cocktail lounges, you had apartment buildings, you had trailer parks that were designed in this, what I like to call high tiki style.
Wasn't only California. I was in Southern Ohio and there was a bar called the Tiki Bar, you know, and you go in there with Polynesian motifs.
Right. It did spread across the entire country, although California, Los Angeles in particular, is where it was born. A lot of people think it was Hawaii.
Well, you've said that there are professional as well as personal reasons, as far as you're concerned, to back this. Talk about those.
Well,
why personally, for example?
I think a lot of people who came of age in the preservation profession in the 90s and early 2000s, in particular, I have a lot of friends in Los Angeles who do what I do, and a lot of them have really become interested in post-war resources because it really speaks to a lot of the themes that were dominant in my grandparents' generation and what the values they held when they came back from the war, the South Pacific in many cases, like my grandfather. And this sort of sense of nostalgia that influenced their culture. But it's not just this sort of kitschy embrace of, you know, post-war nostalgia. I think it really does speak of our culture. And I think things like this are just as important as the obvious monuments that were landmarked in the 1960s and 1970s. You know, the churches and the houses of the rich and all these other landmarks that were initially designated.
Which people think are much more maybe sacred or historical or, you know, have more weight for them. I mean, you mentioned post-war. I guess in L.A. they have fast food places that have been landmarked. And again, this seems out of sorts or out of sync in many people's minds with what a landmark ought to be. And yet that's part of the whole post-war culture, as you say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they've gone a lot further in Los Angeles with landmarking post-war resources because it's the dominant part of their architectural landscape.
And I think I can hear San Franciscans saying, we don't want to be like Los Angeles.
I know. And I'm a resident. I mean, I'm a native of Northern California. So this stuff was widespread throughout the peninsula, San Jose, even San Francisco, the Tonga Room being a primary example.
So what would you say the criteria ought to be for a landmark in general? Just something, I mean, how do you determine this should be preserved?
Well, there are actually defined criteria that the state uses, and not to get into boring details, but there are four different criteria. One is association with events. The second is association with persons. The third is association with important architectural styles, engineering associations, and the fourth is mostly to do with archaeological. So there are defined criteria, which I use to demonstrate that the Tonga Room did meet these criteria.
I'm going to open up the phone lines because I know there are many listeners here who have some thoughts about what ought to constitute or not constitute a landmark, but also who have been to the Tonga Room. What do you think about the Tonga Room as a landmark, but perhaps also just generally what would you think ought to be a landmark and what kind of criteria along the lines that were outlined either by Chris or that you maybe feel are perhaps more appropriate to deciding what a landmark is? I'd like to open the phone lines now and invite you to join us on this. Our toll-free number is available to you, and you can certainly make your own thoughts evident here. It's 866-733-6786. Again, lines are open and available. 866-733-6786. That's toll-free from wherever you're listening or however, radio, internet, Sirius XM, satellite. You can also send an email to us, and we welcome your emails, forum@kqed.org. What else is a landmark, John King, when we're talking about San Francisco landmarks?
Well, you have to remember that in San Francisco, the Doggy Diner advertising sign out near the San Francisco Zoo is a city landmark. And that is pure cultural kitsch. You know, it's just a remnant of people's past. So, again, that's where the subjectivity gets in. I think the challenge as we look at landmarks...
Wait, excuse me, it is pretty subjective. Do we need more strict rules, maybe, on what should be a landmark?
But who's going to define the rules? That's the beauty of it. I mean, and by beauty, I just mean it's hard to say... You know, like, for instance, yesterday I was out looking at some branch libraries that there's talk about creating a landmark district of the 1950s and 60s branch libraries done by a local firm. And it was real interesting kind of looking at them where you can see the cultural things they signify, which is the main argument being made. Then you try to look at the architectural issues and they don't necessarily jibe. But then you kind of look at the additional layer, which is, I think, one of the problems with post-war resources, one of the real sad things that we're still trying to make up for and recover and rediscover is the notion of craft kind of went by the way after World War II. The United States won the war. We defeated Japan and Germany. Technology was going to save us. Part of the theory of urban renewal was you clear it out, you start over. There were all these wonder materials made. We learned we could make bricks cheaper and quicker. We could do all sorts, you know, window frames cheaper and quicker. A lot of these materials just don't endure the way that your kind of classic old warehouse, which is the heavy stone, the heavy brick, things like that. There's a certain resonance in their quality, which maybe is a subjective word, but they're kind of, it's much easier for them to adapt to era after era than you go to these post-war libraries and the bricks are just kind of pulled out of the oven. There's a real, you know, so that's part, I'm sorry for what such a rambling answer, but it's hard to set a set level of qualities. It's like, you know, what are you going to say? How many arches in the window?
But there is a sense subtextually in what you're saying that something has maybe more historical weight and more endurance behind it. And you would say what to that, Chris?
Well, I think that the standards of what is significant have evolved over time. For example, the warehouses that you're mentioning, John, in the 70s and 80s wouldn't have been valued and were torn down in large numbers. And in fact, I first got into this field interested in vernacular industrial resources. For example, the Dog Patch neighborhood in San Francisco, we designated as a city landmark district in the 90s. And there was a lot of opposition to that. But I think now a lot of these industrial areas people do value. So things just evolve as earlier resources are designated and understood as being important, starting with the Victorians and working our way up to post-war resources.
Well, we're going to work our way into some of our callers and find out what they think about this. Our producer, Tina, says maybe the Bank of Marin, where Patty Hearst supposedly made a heist, is that worthy? I mean, you do get into these interesting questions.
I think that would definitely could make the argument.
Yeah, well, let's hear what our listeners have to say. We go first to Ash in Sausalito. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for joining us.
I am calling from a boat that was built in 1939, and my question is, what sort of criteria are out there for boats as historical buildings? Where I grew up in Chicago, if a building was old enough, it would be labeled as a historical building and then would be available to have grants to fix it up, things like that. And I know that one boat by the same designer that built my boat in 1939 was also labeled in that way. So I'm curious about not necessarily museum quality boats of that age, but boats that are, you know, built of solid teak and mahogany by craftsmen from an era that is gone.
Well, you could also label the whole Sausalito houseboat area historical. Right. If you're going to call Dog Patch historical, yeah, John?
Yeah, I'm here at the moment. I've learned a lot about it. Very interesting community. My boat's kind of unique because it was built so long ago, and it is kind of a more of a Master Mariners type boat.
You just want your boat to be a landmark, Ash.
I would love to get that status, but I see a lot of boats around me that go to pieces for lack of appreciation or lack of the monetary means to do it. And that's all up and down the coast and East Coast and Midwest as well.
Now, let's get John King. You were going to respond to him.
No, in terms of Sausalito, I mean, you definitely the overall district. I don't know. Maybe Chris knows it. I can't imagine in terms of single boats or things if there is a landmark category.
It is possible to landmark, to designate a boat as a historic resource. In fact, I think the Balclutha is a city landmark, if I'm not mistaken.
There's a big boat I was just on down in Long Beach. huge, I mean, but they've got restaurants in it and everything. Mm. One of these huge cruisers.
Yeah, I think it tends to be more for history than craft. Like probably FDR's yacht, the Potomac that's in Oakland, I wouldn't be surprised if that's not a declared landmark.
And certainly the Queen Mary in Long Beach you speak of.
Yeah, it was the Queen Mary, right?
Yeah, is a landmark because of its architectural significance. It's an Art Deco masterpiece.
What does it mean to be a landmark? I mean, in specific. So what kind of, I mean, other than the status and cachet and the fact that, you know, attention is called to people who are interested in finding out historical or cultural references and so forth, what else goes with it? Any tax advantages, for example?
There can be. It's largely honorific. It doesn't necessarily prevent somebody from demolishing it. It is still possible. And there are various city and state incentives to assist in restoration that are available. So it can be quite lucrative.
We'll go to more of our callers. And by the way, if you've actually been in the Tonga Room, and I know many of you have, it'd be interesting to hear what you think about turning the Tonga Room into a landmark because it is pretty kitschy. Tom, go ahead. You're on.
Hi, this is Tom Graham. John, I worked with you at the Chronicle for many years.
The walking guy.
I'm just finishing up walking every street of San Francisco and over roughly about 1,200 miles. Mm-hmm. And along the way, you know, I've seen all kinds of buildings that seemed deserving of landmark status. I remember when I was doing the research on this, there were 18,500 buildings that predate the 1906 earthquake and fire. That are still in existence and standing, more than 13,000 Victorians. How do you determine, you know, which ones to preserve? They're a lot deserving, and I'm not sure they're getting the attention.
Well, Tom's right. That's a vexing question here, really. John King?
Part of it is the initiative. Either the owner wants it or people want to stop the owner from tearing it down.
Uh-huh.
Or it's done at more of a neighborhood level. I think you're going to see a lot more landmarks in San Francisco because there have been a number of historic neighborhood surveys done.
And there are a lot of petitions about the Tonga Room, in fact, when the condominium talk started, condominium conversion.
Yeah, that's kind of a one-by-one basis. But, you know, you go to a place like Pacific Heights or the Castro that has lots of Victorians. It's not like the city has someone going down the street starting landmark proceedings on each one. It's kind of each one rises for a different reason.
I understand a lot of people are resistant to having their buildings determined or considered for landmark status because of the restrictions put upon them architecturally and what have you that otherwise they might be willing to do, but it puts sometimes a financial burden upon them if they want to make any changes.
That can be true. I mean, especially if it goes to interiors, although that's not as true in San Francisco. But Los Angeles, there's a lot of wrestling right now over, you know, can you fix the kitchen in your Eichler, so to speak?
Go ahead, Tom. Sorry.
There's an interesting building that, you know, probably few people are aware of that's owned by the city. It's the oldest city-owned building in existence. And ironically, it's not in San Francisco. It's up at Camp Mather. It's called Hog Ranch, and it dates back to 1856, the Gold Rush era. It's a fantastic old log building, but it seems like nobody's interested in taking a look at it for landmark status because of a lot of these financial considerations.
Tom, we thank you for the call. And do you know that?
I don't, but I saw Chris nod.
Chris, you know it, yeah.
Vaguely.
Just vaguely, yeah. Was it Angel Island, for example, because of all the immigration went through, was declared as a historical landmark. And now there's a recently created, I just think last year, commission for historic preservation in San Francisco?
Yes. The voter, well, probably going back to 1968, there's been a historic landmarks advisory board that could recommend landmarks, and then the planning commission could accept them, and then the board of supervisors could ratify it. Voters last fall approved a measure that made the advisory board into an actual city commission. So the Historic Preservation Commission would now vote to make things a landmark. That choice would go to the Board of Supervisors to ratify it. So it would not no longer be a planning decision. It would go straight from historic landmarks to the Board of Supervisors.
And we'll go to more of your calls. We go to Amanda next. Amanda, join us. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, when Trader Vic's closed in San Francisco, there was no mention of it. Nobody cared. And I am curious as to what makes a particular Polynesian bar more distinctive than the next.
There you go, Christopher.
I completely acknowledge that comment, and I miss the old Trader Vic's dearly. That was one of the first post-Oakland Trader Vic's that closed on Cosmo Way.
Rumors about more rum in a Polynesian bar, I guess. But, I mean, she's really asking, what distinguishes a Polynesian bar or makes it different from other bars?
Well, there's a whole scale, whole sliding scale ranging from, in the 50s, it was very popular for Chinese restaurants to add a few thatched fronds and a few Polynesian drinks to their menu and call it a tiki bar. You know, at the bottom end of the scale, all the way up to these full-on architectural masterpieces like the Tonga Room, the old Trader Vic's, the Mai Kai in Fort Lauderdale that, you know, have pools and built-in architectural artifacts. The Tonga Room, for example, has the island hut. It has the canoe hut. It has the, you know, it's not just applied ornamentation. It's actual architecture, interior architecture.
Although the flip side is I got an email in response to my column yesterday saying, listen, when they turned the swimming pool into the centerpiece of a bar, they destroyed the space. So here's a guy who's been resenting the change going back to 1945. You know, that's one of the things that can be, and I'm not talking about the Tonga Room in this instance, but one of the things that can be dangerous about landmarking, realistically, cities are layer after layer after layer. Changes go on and on and on. If we suddenly decide, okay, the change stops here, then it's kind of, in a way, we're denying the natures of city, which is the accretion of layers. For instance, one of the branch libraries I went to that's been modernized was nice and light and airy, and it had a real nice insulated wooden ceiling. And that library had been mentioned at the previous week's hearing as being, oh, the historic integrity's been destroyed. I went to one of the unrenovated libraries from the same architects, and the roof was this kind of crummy, your basic, with all due respect to quality, one of your kind of crummy 60s tie, you know, ceilings that haven't worked well. And it's not just that it was stained, but it was the kind that just the material hasn't held up. So to me, kind of, you added a new type of ceiling that worked better. But if it's a straight character defining quality, someone could say, well, no, we've got to keep the same sort of system in rather than the visual change. So that's where it gets tricky.
It's tricky indeed, and when we return, we'll find out what more of our listeners have to say about this. If you've just joined us, the Polynesian kitsch of San Francisco's Tonga Room has sort of set off a debate here, but you take that and you go from that to the stern modernism of some of the city's public libraries, and all these various architectural styles have their fervid supporters. We're considering what makes a site worth preserving with John King, who's here with us in studio, urban design writer with the San Francisco Chronicle, and with Christopher Plank, who is an architectural historian. Again, you can join us. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786 or send us an email, forum@kqed.org. We'll break and then we'll be back. More of your calls and emails. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Listening to Forum, I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour about what should or shouldn't be designated as a landmark. Two of the key adjectives are distinctive and significant, and there are all kinds of historical, cultural ways of assessing what ought to be a landmark. Christopher Plank is here with us. He's an architectural historian and is with Kelly and Verplank Historical Resources Consulting, and he is filing for the Tonga Room. The Tonga Room set off a lot of this debate in an article that John King from the Chronicle wrote in yesterday's San Francisco Chronicle, and John King is an urban design writer and journalist for the San Francisco Chronicle. We're asking the question to you, our listeners, about, well, if you know the Tonga Room, should that faux kitsch tiki bar be a landmark? I'm sorry, sound like I'm ridiculing the whole notion here, and I'm not. I'm just saying that on the face of it, to some people, landmarks seem to carry all kinds of historical significance and distinction and so forth. And this is, you know, pretty much a bar. On the other hand, but an architectural bar, both internally and as Chris has been saying, a place of cultural memory. And we're talking about really, again, what ought to be designated, what the criteria ought to be to designate something as a landmark. Let's go to more of your calls. And David, we'll go to you first. Welcome, David. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I understand the concepts of the second, the third, and fourth criteria, and somebody mentioned the word restoration. It's my understanding that this Tonga Room was completely gutted no less than 2 years ago, and not restored, but reinterpreted and redesigned, and is completely new from what it was back in the heyday, and what we want to what. We're trying to preserve here. As they say on Antiques Roadshow, you know, this rifle would be worth $50,000 if you didn't refinish the butt of the rifle. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, Christopher Plank.
They really didn't make that many changes. They were mostly aesthetic. They changed the carpeting.
Put about $1 million into it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they actually put up some plexiglass panels, some new wall hangings, but they didn't really change the character of the place significantly.
David, thank you for the call. Of course, it raises an interesting question, though. If the butt of the rifle has changed, you know, and in many instances when we look at landmarks, we see them.
Part of the thing in determining a landmark is to then have kind of determining characteristics of the building. So if a building or something is declared a landmark, there are certain things that are saying this is why it's declared a landmark. You know, the marble lobby, the, you know, the columns outside, the lava rocks at the entrance. You know, so you kind of decide these are the touchstones that lift this space up, as opposed to something like a non-contributing feature like the carpet type of thing.
On we go to more of our callers. Carla, good morning.
Hi, good morning. This is Carla Short calling. I am actually the urban forester for the Department of Public Works, and I was hoping to get in a plug for landmark trees. I think a lot of people aren't aware that trees can also be landmarked in San Francisco, and the Urban Forestry Ordinance of the Public Works Code allows for trees that have exceptional characteristics, whether they're rare species, special physical characteristics, historical characteristics, and sometimes associated with an important building or site, like some of the landmark buildings, cultural significance or environmental significance. And I just wanted to get a plug in for
you. Can do individual trees. I assume you could do a whole arboretum in the Golden Gate Park then, too.
That's right. You can nominate individual trees or you can nominate groves of trees. And currently we have about 20 individual or groves that are formally landmarked, which allows them special protection. The Board of Supervisors approves these trees, and they have to be protected from physical damage, and they are just a great opportunity to raise awareness of the many benefits that trees provide to the citizens of San Francisco and the city of San Francisco.
Well, thank you for the call, Carla.
All right, thank you.
Good to hear from you this morning. Some trees get special protection, I guess. Jalyn is joining us next. Good morning.
Hi, Mr. Krasny.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Mr. Krasny. Thank you for taking my call. This is Jalyn Braswell calling from Pleasant Hill. There's this one place in San Francisco that I really think should be a memorable landmark, which is Harvey Milk's Camera Store in the Castro District. Because Harvey Milk, you know, who was the first openly gay elected supervisor to serve as the Board of Supervisors for the city and county of San Francisco, along with Mayor George Moscone until 1978, they both were assassinated by Dan White. You know, Harvey Milk was dubbed by many of the residents of the Castro District, the mayor of Castro Street, and he used his camera store as like a campaign headquarters along with Ann Cronenberg. And at first, he opened it up with his ex-lover, Scott Smith. And I really think that should be a huge landmark to be part of the landmark list in San Francisco. Any ideas from you guys?
It actually is a landmark. It's landmark 227. It was landmarked in 2000 by Tim Kelly, who is my business partner, who was then the president of the San Francisco Landmarks Board, and he really took it on as his mission to designate important cultural resources to various communities in San Francisco.
Kevin just handed me something. This is just interesting to those who are interested in such things. In mythology, A tiki is a male figure in Polynesian myth, sometimes identified as the first man, a wooden or stone image also of a Polynesian god, and a Maori figurine representing an ancestor, often intricately carved from greenstone and worn about the neck as a talisman. Just sort of annotating things here and giving you a little bit of footnote information, esoteric. But
history with your radio.
Absolutely. Here's a listener, Matthew, gives us kind of a review. He says, I've been to the Tonga Room several times, and while the room has impressed me, nothing else has. The drinks are mediocre at best, the service was ambivalent if not surly, and the prices were incongruous to quality. That being said, I'd hate to see it go. What I'd love to see happen is a third party come in to manage the Tonga Room operation, preferably the staff of Forbidden Island in Alameda, a far superior tiki bar, at least in regards to the bar part. So you got a little review there. Here's Dana in Berkeley who writes, preserving mid-century buildings is important because 50 or 100 years from now, if we haven't, we won't have any examples from that era. Post-war era is and will be in our history. And you'd say what to that, Chris?
I absolutely agree with that. It's interesting. I'd like to point out that such a small percentage of buildings and structures and trees in San Francisco actually have any formal historic status, and that includes Victorians. And I think that the post-war resources are a tough sell to a lot of people because they saw them built. How can that be historic? But it takes a while to – it takes perspective. And I think when you pass the 45, 50-year mark, you start to be able to have a perspective on the significance of these resources, either cultural, architectural, what have you.
More of your calls. Sarah, join us. You're on Forum. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to talk about tiki bars as sort of in San Francisco, sort of a rite of passage for many of us. The Tonga Room is where we went post-prom in the 70s. And tiki bar out on Geary, Trader Sam's, is where many of us look forward to taking our first legal drink. So I think they should be preserved, and I'm all for it.
Okay. Thank you for that. And I suspect there are many who remember prom night at the Tonga Room as a part of their cherished memories of that place. Let's go to Alameda next. Nancy, join us. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to let you know that my parents were both lifeguards when it was a pool. And then over the years, you know, they always told me nice things about it, and they would go there. And then on my 16th birthday, the family took me out there and helped me to feel real special. And it was just visually beautiful, and I had many friends who would go there and have a delightful time.
So you, Nancy, also like the idea of it being a landmark for those kinds of personal reasons.
Right.
Thank you for that. John, they often can't be separated from. Right?
Well, no, that's true. But here's an example. I mean, what's kind of interesting getting into the cultural and the memory. A landmark in Berkeley, a city that is well beyond San Francisco in terms of how it tries to define landmarks. Spenger's Restaurant is a landmark.
Yeah.
The interior... I mean, it's the whole building, but very much because of the interior, all the kind of oceanic paraphernalia and things. Now, when I grew up, you know, getting in the generational thing, Spenger's was a place where I grew up in Walnut Creek. We'd go there sometimes for a real event. You'd always have to wait for an hour and a half, so on and so forth. It was like the place. So when the family kind of ran out of steam and decided to close it, the city declared it a landmark. It sat for a while. A seafood chain came in. Reopened it. But you know, the place has changed. It is no longer a cultural place. It is no longer a gathering place. And it's still there, you know, after it opened.
You see the wall when you go down University Avenue.
You see the wall, you go in, and it's still cool inside. And my wife and I have been there with our daughter. But, you know, it's like kind of the food isn't that good, so on and so forth. We haven't gone back. And I never hear anyone talking about it. So I'm not saying that that makes the architecture any less of a landmark. But so much, these places are kind of like impregnated with memories. But the fact is, life keeps going on. The family that made Spenger's so unique, including the look of it, they moved on, and now it's owned by a big chain. And I'm sure people go there and say, oh, this is kind of cool. But it's not like it's part of the shared culture the way that it was in the 60s or 70s.
Isn't that true for some of the fast food places in L.A. too?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, for example, Bob's Big Boy in Toluca Lake was designated a landmark. And it's interesting because the owner was initially opposed to it, but then it became the number one grossing store in the entire chain because all of the LA-based and cruisers would show up there on Friday nights, and it became a huge moneymaker because of all the publicity.
We're also going to go to another caller on the island of Alameda. Gene, that's you. Hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for having this program and having me on. I'm Gene Metz, the president of the John Marsh Historic Trust, and I'm calling about the architectural historic jewel, the 1856 stone house east of Mount Diablo. It should be a landmark status. It's on the National Register of Historic Places. It's also one of Save America's Treasures. It was the site of the first organized overland group, immigration group in 1841, ended up at this site. It's the center also of the state's newest state historic park, and yet it does not have landmark status. And we need all the support that we can get to raise funds to stabilize and then restore this amazing house. Could I get some comments on that?
Well, where is it, first of all, Gene?
It is four miles east west of Brentwood on the eastern slopes of Mount Diablo, Marsh Creek Road. Why it's not better known as a 1856 jewel major historic site, it is quite we cannot get publicity.
Do you have a website? You want to give out a website or a phone number or something?
We do have a website, the John Marsh Historic Trust.
.org?
Yes.
And do you know it, either of you? No, you know it?
Surely you'll get it.
Yeah, it's a great little, yeah.
Great little? Would you continue?
No, it's a great little, I mean, I think something like that, there's no problem getting landmark status for it. I mean, the challenge is getting the money to fix it up and keep it sound for the next century.
That's correct. And we need all the publicity and support that we can get. And it's very difficult to get to raise the money to do just that.
You've just given yourself some good publicity here. Chris, you want to add anything to that particular?
Yes, Gene. I actually used to work for Page and Turnbull, who did a report on the John Marsh House a couple of years ago. And I was really blown away by the antiquity and the architectural significance of this property. And I think everything that can be done to get money to aid in its restoration would be really great, although it's really tough to do this for a lot of state parks projects that have been starved of funds for years now. It's very difficult to raise money for some of these projects.
Good luck to you, Gene. I'm glad you got this on the air. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we go to more of your calls. We'll get John on next. John, join us. Hi.
Good morning, Michael and John and Chris. On the Tonga Room, yes, thumbs up. Say that on your caller about with this historic boat, he should go to the special anchorage in Saucedo or Richardson Bay. But, Michael, I'm calling about a site which is distinctive and significant, and that is the Presidio, where trees are being cut even now, which has a unique character and legacy, of course, in flora and fauna. But above all the uses of this national park, the GGNRA, which are threatened by a surface freeway project. Michael, I work with a band of engineers who totally debunked the hype and the misstatements deployed by this freeway project, Doyle Drive. Is safe, it is capable for the next 70 years. It deserves an appropriate, elegant rehabilitation by Caltrans to save the Presidio and the character of the Presidio as it is. That rehabilitation will cost about $2/3 billion. The freeway, the surface freeway barrier, which will completely alter, define, and destroy Crissy Field Presidio, is a $1.4 billion project. Just absolutely ruinous, and above all, obsolete, because the traffic has gone away. We've made this case, the Chronicle helped me make it, in rejoinder to John King's article or a review on the Jane Jacobs, Bob Moses book. So let's try and save the Presidio. Let's rehabilitate Doyle Drive. Let's discard this obsolete freeway project, which came out of 40-year-ago traffic patterns. What say you, gentlemen?
All right.
We need to do a Doyle Drive show.
Yeah, we need to do a Doyle Drive show. Some thoughts, John, from you?
I've looked into it a bit, but it's one of these things where kind of every engineer that's worked on the project for the last 20 years from kind of a public contract point of view says there are major issues that require this being thoroughly renovated and essentially rebuilt. But there is definitely a band of people who say that is wrong from point one.
And Chris, anything to add?
Not really.
Okay. We thank the caller. We go to some emails. Faye writes, the year was 1983. I was a law student in San Francisco, fresh from New York. I found the Tongaroom's discounted happy hour and free food to be my perfect getaway spot. I love kitsch. I wore my garish lime green Hawaiian shirt there, much to the embarrassment of fellow stage students. I'd hate to think of the Tongaroom's demise, but frankly, I haven't been there in more than a decade, and I was unaware it was still open. As the Fairmont Hotel planned the replacement condo tower in better economic times, do you think condos are still a wise idea and will actually be a viable replacement? I plan a Tongaroom visit this week, and I still have the garish lime green shirt. Tongaroom is a place the late Hunter S. Thompson would have fit in. Anybody want to comment on whether or not...
Honestly, yeah. My guess is that the Tongaroom will be with us for a while. And the condo tower is such a kind of high boom idea that anything will fly, and I can't imagine that thing rolling forward in the next 5, 6, 7 years. And also, if the Fairmont management's smart, they're going to realize, hey, this is a way to connect with the locals. Let's make this place good. Let's have Chris Verplank serve drinks at happy hour. Yeah, I mean, seriously, it's clearly there is an affection.
There's an idea. Celebrity waiter, Van Plank. Rob writes, I went to the Tongaroom before my high school senior ball back in 1973. It was tacky then. 36 years later, the idea of preserving it is ludicrous and fodder for libertarians everywhere. Save landmark status for things other than failed business enterprises. What about the issue, Greg writes, of financial burden? I don't know if the Tongaroom is financially successful and to what degree. What if the landmark in question weren't that successful and was indeed a financial burden to its owner? Would it still make sense to designate it a historical landmark, forcing the current owner to maintain that burden or suffer a financial loss when they can no longer afford to operate the location? What are the financial ramifications around a historical designation?
Well, first off, I'd like to point out that ever since it was announced that the Tongaroom might be disappearing, business has been booming. Every time I go there, there's a long wait to get into the bar. The restaurant, not so much, but the bar is full to the gills. I think that a lot of businesses, or actually not businesses, but buildings that house businesses that have been landmarked across the state have experienced a lot of publicity that has actually helped the businesses in the long run.
Mike writes, on October 1st, 2004, Tiki expert Otto von Stroheim said in an article in the San Francisco Chronicle, quote, let's get one thing straight, Tiki is not kitsch, end of quote.
So there.
And here's another listener who says, I nominate the Roxy for landmark status. 100 years of showing films continuously. It's nearly as old as film itself. Actually, that's a pretty good nomination, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Good idea. Let's go to some more calls here, and let's hear from Angel in Sebastopol. Good morning.
Michael, I used to live in San Francisco, and back in the 70s, my friends and I made a lot of fun of the Lost Weekend Bar out on Taravel because of its association with that very depressing movie with Ray Milland, the Lost Weekend, and it was all about alcoholism. Well, one day we decided to go into that bar, and we had a marvelous time. It was great fun, very elegant, had an organist and who played organ and piano, and it was a beautiful post-war bar. And even the exterior architecture way down on Taravel Avenue was also post-war. And I'm just wondering if you know anything about that bar and if it still exists.
Either of you know anything about it? No?
I just want to know if you stayed all weekend or not.
No, we didn't. We had a great time, though, and we just decided to pluck up our courage and actually go in there and see if it was depressing like the movie. And it was anything but that. And it had been in existence since the early to late 40s. I can't remember, but I believe it was all formed around that theme.
Well, I'm sorry nobody here can share in your nostalgia, Angel, but I'm sure there are listeners there who may indeed remember, and I thank you for the call. Of course, that whole area, Taravel, I remember, it used to be very different than it is now. It used to be kind of, just a whole different kind of neighborhood. It's changed. We have another caller in from Menlo Park. Phyllis, good morning.
Oh, good morning. What a great show. And I love John King's articles. I look forward to them all the time.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm a freelancer for the Crown quite often. I've written about historic houses in the Santa Clara Valley, and I think the most important one of all is I think it's important, but I know it's endangered, is the Juanabrionis adobe from 1844. And you're probably familiar with her name. She also was a founder, a pioneer in North Beach before she came down here. And it's very much endangered. So landmark, and it is landmark status, but that doesn't save things forever. I mean, we've been able to delay the owner tearing it down. But anybody from around the Palo Alto area needs to put pressure on the city council to save that Juanabrionis adobe up in the hills near Arrastradero Road.
We thank you for that, Phyllis, and getting some interesting calls from listeners, as I expected we would, talking about landmarks this hour. We're talking with John King and Christopher Plank, and you're listening to Forum. And this is Pledge Week for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support this radio station, sort of a landmark in its own right, KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Bring in more of our callers now. In Berkeley, Sally, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to let you and your listeners know that my family has been going to the Tonga Room for the kids. The kids have been a magical place for my kids, for my brother's kids, and we try and go when they're in town. And then when they got older and Megan, my niece, applied for architectural school, she used the Tonga Room as an example of architecture that she felt was important, and she used it in her application, and she got into USC, School of Architecture, based on her essay about the Tonga Room.
Christopher Plank is smiling. Actually, so is John King here, but Chris's smile may be a little wider than that. Sally, good to hear from you. Thank you for that call. And let me go to Greenbrae. Marvin, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, I'm Marvin Croster. I worked as a stationary engineer in 1967 when they remodeled the Tonga Room, and it was quite interesting. They took all the original basic technology that was there. They had plywood cutouts of lightning with flashing lights behind it, and they changed it to strobe lights, and they took the old raft out and put a new raft in, and they had ship riggers come in and do the dance floor, and they had a fellow from Hawaii come in and do all the work on the around the edges of the pool, rather than looking like a swimming pool. It had the coral, and behind the bar they put a waterfall and everything. It was quite interesting to see. I guess that was when the Swigs owned it, and
yeah,
it's probably changed quite a bit now.
Yeah, well, it is under different ownership now. Marvin, thank you for that memory. Appreciate that. We're going to Santa Clara next, and Lisa, let's hear from you. Good morning.
Hi. I read an article recently in the Chronicle that Stowe Lake in Golden Gate Park may be changing quite a bit. I think that they're thinking about putting a restaurant in right next to the lake, and it's just so quaint and peaceful over there. I thought that was a real shame.
I think the issue is more the operator of the restaurant, that the idea would be to kind of upgrade and things like that, which maybe works against people who just want to grab a hot dog and popcorn when they're at Stowe Lake. I don't think it's add a new facility.
Oh, okay, because according to this article that I read in the Chronicle,
obviously it wasn't by John King, yeah.
It's up for bid right now, and it's very controversial because people are a little bit concerned that it's going to draw in a lot of crowds and really not give it that peaceful feeling that it has over there right now. Because I think it's just a snack bar right now, if I'm not mistaken, and a boat rental.
Well, I think we don't know, but thank you for the call. I'll get another call on, and that's you, Phil. Hi, good morning.
Good morning. I was born and raised in San Francisco, and when I was a kid going to school, we used to take the streetcar out to Flyshacker Zoo, the beach, the swimming pool, and we'd go over there to Doggy Diners for a cheap dog. And I know they had this big brouhaha over restoring the head because it was weather-beaten. So they restored it, and they put it on top of Doggy Diners. And then that place closed, and it's in the middle of the street now. And when I pass by, I smile and laugh because it brings happy moments of happy days without a car. And does it really make sense to anybody else? Quick comment about the Tonga Room. When I first went, it was wonderful, amazing. Now I think it's hokey. But anyway, about that dog, does it make sense now? It only makes sense to people like me who went to school, high school, with kids.
Well, that is one of the issues of saving cultural, pure popular cultural artifacts, and that's what I was kind of clumsily doing when I was talking about Spengers in Berkeley, is that there is a wave of the generations. You know, so something like the Doggy Diner Head that was very much championed by people who remembered growing up in San Francisco and all. You know, 20 years from now, it's just this odd head that's kind of perched out by the zoo.
But those people want to tell their kids when they drive by the Doggy Diner, that's where I went, just like this caller. I mean, it has that kind of continuity to it.
Right. No. But as he's pointing out, time keeps going on one day. Imagine if the coolest old plush French restaurant in San Francisco in the 19th century had been saved as a landmark, the interior. You know, it'd be kind of interesting, but the idea that this was the meeting place of all of the culture of the era would be 100 years. I'm not saying that doesn't make the Doggy Diner a landmark. I'm just saying the caller's right that 100 years from now, it's kind of, oh, I think Granddad said there used to be a fast food place there.
It's a fascinating question. Again, it gets back to what's distinctive, what's significant. One person's distinction and significance is another's fie on it, and vice versa. It's been a good hour. I thank you both. Chris Verplank, again, is architectural historian with Kelly and Verplank Historical Resources Consulting, and John King is urban design writer and journalist with the San Francisco Chronicle. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, to our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.